and welcome to The Dividing Line. We are a little bit early today because I just finished up doing a program. I'll tell you about that in a moment because we're going to open the phone lines today. 877-753-3341. 877-753-3341. I mentioned that on Twitter as well. So if you would like to join us, then that is the number. We only have 1 hour today. It's not going to be a jumbo or a mega or anything else. We will be wrapping up at the top of the hour. So 877-753-3341. That is a number for you ZGen folks that you pick up a telephone and, you can press buttons and it's very old fashioned. I realize it's not a URL. I wonder how many people actually know what URL means, Universal Resource Locator. But I remember when URLs first came along, and there are many people in this audience have no earthly idea. No. 877-753-3341 just finished, the third sweater vest dialogue, which is why I'm wearing a sweater vest, but it is a black sweater vest. Shows everything. Good grief. It is a black sweater vest. No Coogee today. Sorry. I just didn't want to make Doug Wilson feel bad that he doesn't have anything like that. But I did discover something fascinating today. The topic was cool, too. But they have taco time in Moscow, Idaho. I am so thrilled to know that when I go to Moscow, I will be able to eat food. Not that I was really overly concerned about that. Yes, they have taco time in Moscow, Idaho. I'm very, very happy about that. And I'm very much looking forward to, I'm going to be up there. Today's the 20th. So next month, technically, but in about 3 weeks, I'll be in Moscow. Doug and I are going to be, having a debate on paedo baptism and paedo communion, the ordinances and who they are for. It's going to be short, not as long as I would like it to be, but we're going to be doing that. And then we're going to be doing a man rampant episode on the textual issue as well, where we disagree on that. And so we just did a discussion on Tolkien and Chesterton, but much more about Chesterton than we did about Tolkien. Doug had done an 8-minute video about his belief that Chesterton was a saved individual despite his Roman Catholicism. And so we discussed that whole very, very important issue. How is a person saved? They're saved by the gospel. We ended up getting a whole lot closer in our perspectives, maybe not so much in how we would express things, but we got a whole lot closer by the end. It was very useful, very useful. That's what we want these things to be. You can tell a fundamentalist. A fundamentalist is a person who is afraid of hearing both sides discussing something. And, of course, the fundamentalist wants not only one side to be heard, but if both sides are heard, then the one side just simply needs to be anathematizing the other and saying, you're going to hell, you need to repent, etc. So you can sort of tell a fundamentalist attitude that says there can be no discussion. We don't want to even hear about any of that type of stuff. So hopefully it'll be useful to everybody else to hear a discussion and the conclusion that there is only one gospel and that you need to default to the assumption that the gospel needs to go first before anything outside of that, and that both Doug and I agree that Pope Francis is loopy. We did... Not that that's actually most of my Roman Catholic friends would likewise come to that same conclusion that Pope Francis is loopy. So that wasn't a big deal. Anyhow, so we're taking your phone calls. We covered so many topics on the last program that I've already got a few queued up. And before we go to Terry, hold on just a second, Terry. I do need to mention just one thing. I am aware of the deconversion story saga going on right now. Specifically, the Ear Biscuits guys, the fellow by the name of Rhett and Link, I think are the names. I think I mentioned this all to you before, but I listened to Rhett's story. It's an hour and 44 minutes long, as I recall. I listened to his deconstruction story on a 100-mile bike ride a couple weeks ago. And while listening to it, I was like, there's a lot of stuff here that would be worth addressing. But I also recognized it was going to be extremely hard. It would be very time-consuming, in essence, to take something that long and break it down into meaningful sections that you can address in a fashion. I sent a link to it to Jason Lyle because there was a lot of discussion of evolutionary issues in it. So he would be aware of it. I did not hear the next week, which was Lynx also becoming an agnostic or something. I'm gathering from the fact that I was sent this morning a place with a video where the two of them for about 45 minutes are being interviewed as to the response to their having said these things. Haven't had a chance to listen to much of that, only a few moments of that. Maybe I'll throw it into, I do have a 100K ride this weekend, so maybe I'll try to listen to that. But I also have a bit, you know, I'm only debating Doug Wilson next month, and then we've got General Conference, and Jeff Durbin and I are debating up there at the University of Utah again, probably in the very same room. We are, as I said, going to have very large people staying at the doors, making sure no one brings any engine coolants, Prestone, into the debate. I think that would be an appropriate security measure on our part. I think that's a good idea. And so it's not like I don't have – and then dialogue at BYU after conference on very, very important topics and issues. It's not like I don't have stuff coming up. And, of course, the rest of the year, I've got tons of stuff coming up that I try to be preparing for ahead of time. So it when I don't necessarily cover something, it's not that I don't think it's important. It's just that there's only one of me, and the entire staff is currently involved in the production of this program. And Rich doesn't do he doesn't do research stuff. He orders stuff for me so I can do research, but he doesn't do my research stuff. So it's all up to me. And so sometimes it's just simply a matter of time, and sometimes I just forget. That's an issue as you get older as well. So let's keep that in mind. So I am aware of the fact that these folks have an audience. I'm also aware that someone has already responded to them. I saw something that involved Mike Lycona responding to them as well. I've downloaded it again. Hours and hours and hours of listening to stuff. There's just only so much of that you can do in a short period of time. But I'm not saying I'm not going to respond. I'm just saying I'm aware of it. I'd like to, but we'll see. The one thing I will say is Rhett's story illustrated for me very clearly why it is that when we do not present a Christian worldview that is cognizant of the opposition in our teaching our young people, in how we preach, when we build the walls around us that never, ever, ever allow for challenge, this is going to be the result. I'm not saying you have to have apologetics classes all the time. What I am saying is if your people are not as a regular part of the preaching and the teaching and the modeling from the pastors, engaging the culture in a knowledgeable fashion, we are setting ourselves up for what Rhett experienced. That doesn't change the fact that he's accountable before God for the light that he's had and for not, you know, some of the other things we could talk about, but I'm just saying that in passing. Okay. All right. Let's get to the phone calls. We have a full board already, and I appreciate that very much. Let's talk to Terry in Oklahoma. Hi, Terry.
Hey, thanks for taking my call today.
Yes, sir.
I just had some recommendations about books I'd like to ask you about. And what would you recommend that I read on church history?
Well, for most folks, it depends on whether you're looking for something short or long.
I'm reading Schaff right now.
That's pretty long. So if you're already reading Schaff, you're already getting the good, solid stuff. I would add to him, you'll probably find very enjoyable, my dear friend Nick Needham's material, his 2,000 Years of Christ's Power. His series on church history is the first one I recommend to people because it's very readable. Much more readable than Schaff is, to be honest with you. Okay. Once you read it, you'll probably go, oh, I wish I had started with this one. So Nick Needham, Needham, 2000 Years of Christ's Power. You'll also, I think, find useful the 2-volume, even though both volumes are huge, so it's more like a 4-volume. The 2-volume set by William Scott, is it William Scott? It's Scott Lauterette. I forget what the first name is. Lauterette, Lauretette. He has a 2-volume set. And one of the things that's nice about that, very scholarly, not necessarily enjoyable to read, but it's good. And it also attempts, unlike most church histories, to include the church in the East. Most Western church histories ignore all of that. There are some excellent books. I don't have them right in front of me right now. But there are some excellent books on the church in the East, just specifically on that subject, despite the fact that there's not a whole lot of information to necessarily go on, especially when you go back farther into history. But it's good to know, that aspect of things. And then beyond large sets, then what you find are individual books that are extremely useful in a particular area. So Owen Chadwick on the Reformation or on the early church, books on African Christianity. You can get much more specialized. It's get a little bit more in depth. You always have to be careful, you know, when you're – doesn't matter who you're reading. You have to be careful. You have to be discerning. Everybody's got their hobby horse. So it's always – so that's what's good about, you know, like if you read Needham and Schaff, they're going to balance each other and give you different perspectives and stuff like that. That's just a necessary aspect, I think, for anybody who's doing meaningful reading is read widely so that you don't end up in a rut.
Right. That's great.
So that's important, too.
What about systematic theology? What would you recommend in that category?
Yeah, you know, you've got your big – standard ones between Grudem and Hodge, and there have been some new ones that have come out just over the past couple of years that I haven't spent a lot of time with. I'm a little bit older. Don't forget Raymond in that list of ones that you want to have on your shelf. But again, just on a personal level, I find books on specific aspects of theology to be much more useful simply because if it's a good book, say, on pneumatology, on the study of the Holy Spirit, it's going to have enough space to make the necessary connections it should anyways, make the necessary connections outside of its own topic to the close by related areas of systematic theology. A person writing a systematic theology is normally trying to do it in a single volume, and as a result, you get a truncated version of stuff. As for an overview, you know, it's sort of like Google Earth satellite view, but if you actually want to find some place, you got to go to Street View, you know, which is a lot smaller.
I got you.
Yeah, it's always good to have a couple in your library, but it's far better to have a good theology section where you've got some good works on the Trinity and good works on soteriology and stuff like that. Because they can... The danger, of course, is that if they're written from, again, in the Western perspective, there may not be a good, a proper amount of connectivity to the rest of mm-hmm. theology, okay? But if it's a good work on those subjects, it will make that connection. So
when you're saying the Eastern perspective,
yeah.
Do you mean the Greek Orthodox churches?
No, when I'm talking about the church in the East that eventually becomes Orthodoxy, but there was a church before that all the way into China, and in fact flourished for a while and then mysteriously disappeared. So when I'm saying when I say Eastern Western in perspective. I am talking about a way of thinking and epistemology. So in the West, I just finished, as I mentioned at the top of the hour, I just finished a dialogue with Doug Wilson on whether Chesterton was a Christian and how that deals with Roman Catholicism. And one of the things that came up was Doug said he would find it much more comfortable and useful to talk to a conservative Roman Catholic who believes Roman Catholicism than to an Eastern Orthodox person, because he's Western, the Roman Catholic's Western, we have a common epistemology, and we can actually butt heads and debate and actually come to a conclusion. Whereas his experience is very similar to mine, and I've talked about this many times before, when you're dealing with Eastern Orthodoxy, you just really, really, really struggle to have a conversation that you could then turn around and explain to anybody else. Let's just put it that way.
Right.
There's
a few people in the town where I live. People come here from Europe for work.
Yeah.
And I've run into a few people who are Serbian Orthodox
mm-hmm.
and Russian Orthodox.
Yep.
And it's really hard to talk to them.
It is.
Maybe it's the language, but I think it's just that we don't.
No, it's a worldview. It's worldview.
Yeah.
If they're coming from there, they may be just very secular and they're very nominal in their religiosity. That's a possibility. You have to find out. The only
right.
way you can do that is from observing them and talking to them. If they are attending church regularly and are dedicated to the Orthodox faith and they're coming from those countries, then, yeah, you're up against the East-West divide big time. And it is a tremendous challenge.
Okay, I just got one more thing I'd like to ask you. What's your favorite commentary on Romans?
John Murray, Douglas Moo, are my two favorite commentaries on Romans from the modern period, relatively modern period. John Murray and Douglas Moo. Okay.
Hey. Thanks a lot, Dr.
Thanks, Terry.
I really appreciate it.
All right.
Have a great day.
Okay, bye-bye. Thankfully, he asked me for book recommendations on subjects that I can actually talk about. I don't like doing book recommendations. You have to have so many things at the top of your head. And if I was doing this program from on the other side of that wall and was able to be mobile – and walk up and down my shelves and go, well, oh yeah, then we got this one. You know, that's different. It's a bit of a challenge. Okay, let's talk to Jacob. Hi, Jacob.
Hi, Dr. White. How are you?
Doing good.
Good. My question is doing apologetics to Mormons. So in our town, we never see Mormons don't wear something on their head that says they're Mormon. So we only ever see the Mormon elders. And I've found it very hard to have, I would say, meaningful conversation with them. And in fact, once they kind of find out that I know more about their religion than the average person and that
right.
I'm a Christian, they kind of shut it down.
Hmm.
And to the point where they actually, there's new ones around here now, but they would refuse to talk to me after one or two meetings.
Yep.
So how do you go about talking to the Mormon elders?
Yeah. Well, I'm assuming you've read my book on the subject.
Yeah, I'm working through it right now.
Yeah. Yeah, Letters to a Mormon Elder was really, really designed as a mechanism to not only be given to Mormons, but to Christians as well. I suppose you could criticize Letters to a Mormon Elder for being out of date, only in the sense that it does assume that the Mormon to whom you're speaking is both knowledgeable and committed to the full orb of LDS thought. Because I could assume that in 1989 when I wrote it.
Right.
That's 30 years ago. And there's things be a changing in Mormonism. Yeah. And you can't assume that anymore. So Letters is still very accurate as to historical LDS teaching and theology. But not so much as to the current LDS experience, where so much of that theology and teaching is being spun in essence within the modern LDS church. So reaching missionaries while they're on their mission is particularly challenging because of the fact that the church seeks to protect them from ever developing relationships that would get past the defensive mechanisms they've already put in place. So, as you may have noticed, missionaries are moved around fairly regularly. They're technically just not allowed to, unless you are showing evidence of a serious movement toward their perspective after a couple of meetings, then they're not going to. They may send another pair of missionaries to just sort of double check on stuff, but they're not going to just meet with you on an ongoing basis over and over again. They have to think that they're making progress with you, because they don't want relationships to be developed that would produce that bridge, because that bridge can go to both directions. And I've been involved in situations. It's been a number of years, unfortunately, partly because I don't get the opportunity to sit down in people's homes with missionaries almost ever anymore because of YouTube. But before YouTube, when I could be fairly anonymous, we were involved in situations where missionaries were sent home and did not finish their mission because they ran into me and they ended up with questions that people didn't want to answer and so on and so forth. So that was a wonderful thing. It's a great opportunity. There's no question about it. But you're up against a system that is specifically designed to protect these young guys from people like you. So they're just. And not only that, but you need to understand that the LDS mission is extremely, it's a time of extreme pressure upon these young men. Sometimes it's the first time away from home. I mean, I've told the story, I've told the story before, but, my son and I had gone to General Conference years and years and years ago, probably more than 20 years ago. And we were flying back on a, America West flight or something back then. And we just happened to book the flight coming back where a group of missionaries were heading out on. So there must have been 20, 25 missionaries on this flight. And if you can imagine this one poor kid ended up in the window seat next to me. can you imagine that? I was heading out on a mission, and I ended up sitting next to James White on a flight out of Salt Lake City. And you could tell he had never – this guy's like from Idaho someplace or something like that. He had never been on a plane before. He shot an entire roll of film out the window before we were in the air for 2 minutes. I mean, it was fun to watch on a sort of, oh, isn't that cute type thing. But you know, these guys, they are away from home for the first time. They are buried in always being around another missionary. That's one of the reasons they do that, is so that you can't get those types of conversations going. Most of the vast majority of the times, remember, the old number was, I don't know what the new number is. The old number 15 years ago, 20 years ago, was that 65% of Mormon missionaries go inactive for a period of 6 months after they come back from their mission. They're burned out.
Yeah.
And that's when the questions that they weren't allowed to think about on their mission come bubbling up.
Right.
And so...
Yeah, I've been listening to Coltish and listening to Dan Tate's story.
Yeah.
And it sounds intense. It sounds really intense.
Yeah.
And I really, I agree with you in that the doctrine that you have in Letters from Mormon Elder is still spot on, but it's changed in that the guys out here are younger than I am. I'm 24. and they don't.
They're just children to me.
As soon as you get to the deeper topics, they call it that. Oh, it's a deep doctrine. We don't really care about that.
Yep. Though that's not necessarily a new thing. I had that happen a lot, even when I was 24, talking to the missionaries. There are certain Mormons. I mean, that's LDS terminology. That's LDS lingo. Deep doctrine. Deep doctrine.
Right.
They will just pull that out. That's not necessarily a new thing, but there's no question about the fact that there was a much higher percentage of missionaries in the 80s and 90s that would go to the wall with you, quote unquote, Bible bash, as they frequently called it, in comparison to today. I mean, there's just, things have changed a lot.
So what would your, I guess, practical advice? And if I just run into them on the street or do get a meeting with them.
Well, if you do get a meeting with them, you're going to have to walk a fine line because you can't expect you're going to get a second one. That used to be something, I mean, I did. Elders Reed and Reese, we met a number of times, partly because I fed them. You could try food. Food for young guys is a good thing, might work out. But you have to walk the fine line between... you're probably only going to get one shot, but you don't want to blow them out the door in the first 5 minutes. So what, I mean, and I've said this many, many times. I'm sure that Jerry and the other guys in Cultish have pointed this out to you as well. But you have to have a goal in mind going in, because in other words, you need to make a decision. I want to make sure these guys know what I believe about God and how it differs from what they believe about God before they leave. Okay? So everything else that's going to happen is going to be oriented in light of the commitment you've made at the beginning to do this. It's like when you get in the car, if you don't have a destination, you're just going to drive around in circles. And the same thing in any witnessing situation. So what I would do is, if you get that opportunity, now obviously if it's a sit down opportunity in your house, then you can assume you're going to have a little bit more time. If it's a out on the street opportunity, you're not going to have a lot of time at all. And so you have to be very succinct and very clear. Here's a nice, helpful way, a suggestion of getting to the point you want to get to without being obvious that you're doing so. And that is, hey, guys, you know, I've done some reading about what you all believe, but help me out here, okay? Let me tell you where I'm coming from, and then you tell me if I'm right that you have different understandings of these things, okay? And what's important about this is we're talking about, you know, this isn't necessarily quote unquote deep doctrine. This is just where you start. And I have to start with God. Because I believe God made me and made you. And so he's the first and foremost thing. And so here's what I believe about God. And then, of course, when you present what you believe about God, what you do is you emphasize all the aspects that are specifically relevant to what you want them to understand when they leave. So you emphasize his eternality, his uniqueness, the difference between man and God, that I am made by God, that I am not of the same species as God. And then you got to be careful, because if you at any one point along the way say, and I understand you guys believe something differently about that, you're opening the door for an immediate change of direction. They're going to jump in and try to move it someplace else. And so you've got to be careful to say something along the lines of, now, one thing I'd like to find out from you here in a moment is, my understanding is you don't agree about this. Maybe you could jot that down, because I want to finish this up here. You're trying to do it in such a way that you're getting it communicated, and then you're hopefully keeping the door open for a meaningful discussion thereafter. But you can't go too long, or you have to sort of watch them and read them. And when there's someone you've never met before, that's challenging. You got to let the spirit sort of help with that.
Okay, cool. Yeah, thank you so much. If it wasn't for you and Jeff, I would have never, ever talked to a Mormon missionary. You guys have been an invaluable resource for me and through me for my church as well.
Well, great.
Thank you so much.
Extremely, extremely encouraging. I will communicate that to Jeff. He's off in Ireland right now, but when he gets back, I'll let him know about that. All right, thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right, God bless. Mm-hmm. Bye-bye. All right, 877-753-3341. Let's talk to Brad up in the once conservative, no longer conservative state of Colorado.
Correct. Yes, you are right, sir.
Yeah, it's sad. And how they flipped that state as quickly as they did is a study in politics. But anyway,
legalization of marijuana did it.
That does help. Yes, sir. What can I help
you
with?
Okay, so the question, I understand it was a little difficult to see what I was trying to ask. So I guess your opinion based on the scriptures of and a person who is, you can use both terms, hermaphrodite or intersex, surgically altering so that they can marry the opposite sex that they are most dominant. Do you see the question, or do I need to go?
Well,
I don't want to get into, like, kind of the more detailed, because it's a radio program, but.
Well, yeah, what, I
is
mean.
That, is that acceptable as a Christian? If you are a Christian, you know the scriptures, and you just. You're more dominant in one area, and you want to marry the opposite sex, and you have to surgically. Is that Christianly, in a way, acceptable according to the scriptures?
Well, here's the problem: is that any type of actually physically intersex situation requires there to be an underlying genetic issue that is involved, and that particular manifest, there are probably 40 different kinds of genetic abnormalities that can manifest themselves and do manifest themselves in an extremely small number of situations. I would say probably at most half of a 1% of the human population, because normally, a genetic mutation along those lines is simply fatal. Those that are not are very rare that they provide live births, and hence it's a small population. I have often said that you must make a huge distinction between a person who is truly genetically abnormal in the sense of having either traits of both sexes, non-functionality along those lines. There's all sorts of manifestations depending on what particular syndrome you have.
Specifically, who I was referring to.
Yeah, those individuals should be people that the church is very quick to provide acceptance and pastoral counseling of, because they happen to be the very same people that will be abused by our society in promoting transgenderism and things like that have nothing to do with genetics at all. It's all a matter of what's going on up here, not the genetics and everything else.
And I told Rich, I agree totally with your stance on that.
Right.
I was just asking.
Right. So, yeah, I'm just Brad, the reason that I'm belaboring this is that when I was on the Dr. Drew show a couple of years ago to discuss transgender issues, this came up, and it was used as a weapon Because most people have never spent any time really thinking about it and don't have personal experience with someone in that context.
And I'm not attacking you. I'm not trying to attack you.
No. And I'm not saying, No. I'm just simply saying, when I answer questions, I want to try to make the question to be as useful to as wide an audience as possible. And so I'm just simply saying the reason I'm giving all the background is so that people can have an understanding of where this is coming from. That would have, and here's the only answer I can give. That is a pastoral question. In other words, okay. It would require a Christian pastor to know the life and faith of the individual. Because I'm assuming you're talking about a Christian, okay? So if you're talking about a believer who is in that situation, then pastorally there has to be an understanding of, is this a union that can produce children or not? Is the person who does not experience the genetic abnormality a person who wants to have children? Is this a situation where adoption would be something that would be something that could fulfill those aspects? So in other words, there's a lot of personal reality on the part of the person and the couple and the church, they would have to be a part of that. So it's sure. So now all of that to say that when you say would medical intervention be appropriate within a Christian context, the only assumption I can make is so that there can be marital relationship.
That was all I was asking, yes.
Okay, but. All right. And
so I'm trying to think of the word exact. So there's not a problem of, I don't know how to say it properly, in a discreet manner. So there's not a problem of the person interacting with the same sex while they're trying to have marital relations.
I'm not following you there, but this is the best I can say. If you have, for example, there's nothing wrong in utilizing medicine and advancements in science to overcome genetic problems in other aspects of our lives. So if you have a person with a genetic abnormality that has resulted in a particular connective issue in an arm, doing surgery to repair that and give them greater strength and mobility in that arm, there would not be any. I can't see that there would be any Christian basis for objecting to something like that. The issue here then would be if you have a genetic abnormality that is causing a physical problem, and we have the ability to ameliorate that, then I can't see that there'd be an objection to that. But that's a separate issue from all the complications that come up when you're talking about a couple marrying where one does not have that. What is the expectation in that type of a situation? And that would have to be dealt with pastorally in each
pastoral
situation.
And private.
I'm sorry?
It would be pastoral and private.
Yes, it would be.
Okay, that's all I was asking. Mm-hmm. I wasn't trying to, I mean, you've answered the question very sufficiently. I wasn't trying to provoke you.
I hope you didn't hear me suggesting that you were. I was just simply saying,
I gave a long answer
because I want to try to help as many people with the question as possible.
Yeah, and I'm clarifying as well.
Anyway,
I'll get off there.
Okay, all right, thanks, Brad.
I love you, Dr. White. Thank you.
Thanks for your call. God bless. Bye-bye. All right. That was a challenging one. Let's talk to Clay in South Dakota. Hi, Clay.
Hello. How you doing?
Doing good.
Thanks for taking my call. Preparing to teach on issues related to inerrancy, and I just wanted to get your perspective or hear how you think about issues related to textual variance and the sovereignty of God.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I just did speak at a conference in Gardnerville, Nevada, which is south of Reno, and I addressed that issue repeatedly, and so I actually haven't as yet linked to the recordings, but I will as soon as they're available. So you might watch, if you follow me on Facebook or Twitter or anything like that, I'll put that information up, and so you can have a more in-depth conversation on the subject than just from a phone call. But if you're familiar with the Chicago Statement on Inerrancy, if you're utilizing that at all in your studying or in your teaching, then you know that it specifically makes reference to textual critical issues and to the issue of variation in the copies, and emphasizes that the issue of inerrancy is an issue of the nature of the product of inspiration. So what is written by the apostles, and doesn't really get into issues of whether the apostle used an amanuensis or something like that. But the point is the point of contact between textual critical issues and inerrancy is in the autograph itself. So inerrancy refers to what the apostle, to boil it all down to what the apostles or the prophets in the Old Testament provide. Now, that does raise issues in regards to the prophets about their oral teaching, but not getting into that. Once it's written, then the issue is what does inerrancy say about the transmission of that written text over time? And the Chicago Statement and the vast majority of teaching scholars, apologists, and everything else will point out that inerrancy is about what was written, and inerrancy is not a claim that God is somehow going to supernaturally prohibit the existence of textual variation in the manuscript tradition, because he didn't. He not only didn't in the New Testament, but we have direct evidence in the New Testament about the Old Testament. So there are places where the New Testament authors quote from the Old Testament, and they quote from differing traditions in regards to the streams of tradition that make up the Old Testament. So you've got the Hebrew, you've got the Greek, you've got the Aramaic Targums, and there are identifiable traditions even between these sources that they utilized. And so, for example, when the writer of the Hebrews quotes from Jeremiah chapter 31, the stream of manuscripts that becomes the Masoretic Hebrew text over time in Jeremiah 31, which is what your Bible is going to be translating almost always in the book of Jeremiah, has the line, "even though I was a husband to them." But then when you look in the book of Hebrews, at chapter 8, when the author quotes, he doesn't quote from the Hebrew. He quotes from the Greek Septuagint. And the Greek Septuagint says, "though I did not care for them." Now those are, "though I was a husband to them," "I did not care for them," are not the same thing. And now the difference in Hebrew is one letter. It's the difference between Baal and Gaal. And Bet and Gimel look a lot alike. That's the only difference between the two. The point is, variations exist. The apostles knew it. The early church knew it. Everybody up until modern times were well aware of the fact that there were variations in the manuscripts. And we on this program have spent, well, just last week, we did one program. It was 2 hours and 44 minutes long, and the majority of that was dealing with this very issue and the people who have tried to come up with a answer to the existence of variation that would be totally non-understandable to anyone in church history prior to the Reformation. And so we dealt with that, and I think it's an important aspect of things. And so when you're teaching on inerrancy, these are on YouTube. If you put James White inerrancy and Cape Town, into YouTube, you should find the lectures I gave, because I've run into them a few times myself, so I know they're out there. I did a conference in Cape Town, South Africa on inerrancy and did an entire segment, an entire lecture on this very subject that would go into more detail. But it would also give you an example of how I would address this within the context of a, you know, basically lay people. It wasn't meant just for scholars or something like that. But how I taught it may be of some assistance as to how you're going to teach it.
Sure. Appreciate that. And do you have any good resources on the apostleship or the apostleship issue in regards to the New Testament?
You mean authorship?
And no, apostleship, like people, the apostles defending their authority as apostles and some of those things. Recently, the reason I ask is there's been some attacks levied against the apostleship of Paul, which I know you're well aware of.
But, yeah, of course, yeah.
And some of it was connected to whether or not he fulfills the role of a prophet from the Old Testament in Deuteronomy. And then basically if you hold to that the way this certain author does, you end up throwing out pretty much all of them in the New Testament other than Jesus and his prophecy concerning the destruction of Jerusalem.
That's very parallel, interestingly enough, to the argument that Abdullah Kunda presented against me in the debate in Sydney about 4 or 5 months ago. I'm not sure if you saw that.
Right, and I watched that.
Okay. Yes. So then I don't remember if I had made reference in my opening to some of the books I had read on the historicity of Paul and his apostleship and stuff like that. I'm not sure that I did. Again, this would be easier if I was in my office. There are a number of works. I just happen to remember Paul, Apostle, Heart Set Free by F.F. Bruce. That's going to go back a little bit earlier. I recommend that to everybody. Rich, you bought 3 or 4 of these books. And I'll tell you what. Let me catch a couple of other calls here. I've only got a few minutes, and while I'm catching these calls, and we're going to need to shut them down here, those books that you bought for me on Paul and Jesus, look them up on Amazon and give me the, because there is one primary author, and it's just the name's not catching me. And what I'll do, if you just listen to the rest of the program, I'll, before I break into the next call or something like that, I'll give you that information, okay?
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Clay. Thanks for your call. All right. Bye-bye. Okay. Let's talk with Stanley. Hi, Stanley.
Hi, James. Thanks for taking my call today.
Yes, sir.
This question has been floating around my brain since I heard Walter Morton talk on it years and years and years and years ago. It was on one of his tapes, as I remember. But it concerns the Trinity, and I still haven't gotten your book, but I need to do that. You probably referenced it in the book, too.
Yeah, I did.
But I think Morton's view was that he viewed Jesus as the eternal Word who became the Son in the Incarnation.
Right.
And I'm wondering if that's a violation of the doctrine of the Trinity or not.
Yeah, with all due respect and love for Walter, it was. And there have been a number of other people who have missed that point. Yes, thank you. It is problematic. The, for example, in Colossians chapter 1, the Son is described as eternally existing in the presence of the Father. Jesus describes himself in that way. The idea of, almost adoptionism or a Logos Christology, which Martin did have some issues with. I don't know, honestly, what motivated him toward those perspectives. There are other people that have promoted the same perspective for a period of time. John MacArthur did as well. He has changed his view on that, and did so like 20 years ago now. it did have some popularity, and but I think it's based upon a fundamental misunderstanding. You don't become the son. This is a relational term, and it is not one that has temporal aspects to it. In the sense of, in the incarnation, the person of the Son is more clearly seen as the one sent by the Father. But that does not mean that in eternity past there was just this undifferentiated logos type concept that existed. So yeah, I do address that in the Forgotten Trinity, and you're not crazy. Walter Martin did have an unusual view on that. Like I said, he's not the only one that has held that. I don't think it's something that's going to obviously send somebody to the fiery pits of hell.
Right.
And so certainly Walter knew the arguments on the other side. I honestly don't know how he responded to them, to be perfectly honest with you. But, but you did detect a difference there, and you're correct. And
I suppose logically that if you took that position, you'd have to say the first person of the Trinity wasn't the Father from all eternity.
It would seem to be a logical step to take at that point, yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Well, okay. Thanks for the opportunity to get that off my chest.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
And out of my head. Thank you.
All right. God bless. Bye-bye. In response to the previous caller, the name that I'm really surprised, I this was on the tip of my tongue. I just didn't want to say it. David Wenham has written a number of books. Now, Wenham is to my left. Okay, so you need to realize just because you recommend something doesn't mean I agree with everything this person said. But he does an excellent job in dealing with the standard, a range of standard arguments against the apostleship of Paul. Some of them are more in depth, some of them less in depth, and he's dealing primarily more with modernistic attacks. Not so much the idea of fulfilling some kind of a, the argument that Paul has to somehow fulfill some kind of a standard for an Old Testament prophet or something, is not something you're going to get out of the New Testament itself. So you have to be careful that you don't translate. I mean, look at Jesus's selection of the apostles. It was not based upon Old Testament categories like that. There is a freedom in God's choice, and Paul's the greatest example of that freedom, because he uses someone who's actually been persecuting the church. There's a lot to be said there, but Wenham's books, there's a number of them. Would be useful to you. Only have a few minutes left. Let's jump back to what used to be a red state and now is a deep blue state. Sadly, let's talk to John in Virginia. Hi, John.
How's it going, Dr. White?
Doing good.
Good to hear from you. Thank you for taking my call. I'm super excited to speak with you.
All right. What's up?
Well, I just wanted to give some ground where a newly reformed Christian as of August of last year. And, you know, I've just been entrenching myself in, you know, the Word and, you know, a lot of your debate. Also watching Jeff Durbin as well. And my preacher recommended reading the book by Tim Keller, The Reason for God. And when I was reading over it last night, you know, he talks about not only questioning your doubts, but for the other side to question their doubts as well. And not to sound like a non-believer, but when I was reading through Genesis, when I read that, you know, God created the world in 7 days, regarding creationism, if I were to speak with somebody that's like a materialist, you know, saying that there's more evidence out there stating, you know, the world took, you know, millions of years to be the way it is now, how do I go about defending that hope that's in my heart when speaking with somebody that, you know, doesn't really have that faith?
Yeah, keep in mind what you just said. To be the way that it is now, that's an interesting description, because we've never had more evidence of the fact that the way it is now is absolutely purposeful, designed, intentional, and necessary. In other words, the fine-tuning of the universe, the fine-tuning of a planet that is capable of sustaining life in the context necessary, and this is where the difference is, in the context necessary for the drama of redemption for the glory of God. This is the issue. That is a category that a secularist and materialist cannot even begin to have, and unfortunately, very few Christians have. Most Christians still have a very man-centered perspective on the world around them. They come into the church, they've been given that from that. That's now the culture around us. It wasn't 100 years ago, but it is now. They bring that into the church, they baptize it, and they put a layer of religiosity over the top. But it's still there. It's still mainly about us. It's still mainly about me. When you start with the recognition that the biblical message is, this is all about God, it's about His glory, and it is about His redeeming a particular people in Christ Jesus to demonstrate the full range of His attributes, not only His power and His wrath, but His mercy and His love and His grace. So you need a particular world in which to do that. And we have more evidence today, not only scientifically in regards to the irreducible complexity of dozens and dozens and dozens of living systems within human beings or animals or whatever else, any living creature, but also the balance that this planet has to have so that this kind of life, this kind of existence can take place. We have so much evidence of that. It is astonishing. I highly recommend. There's numerous books on the subject that just will blow you away when you see that right now in your body, you are reconstituting adenosine triphosphate from adenosine diphosphate with a little mechanical pump in the mitochondria of your cells that we can't even design yet. That's so small, and yet we know it's there. We know exactly what it's doing, and life is dependent upon that. And there's dozens of other things exactly like that. We've never had more information that demonstrates this than we have right now. But all data, facts, and information has to be interpreted within a worldview. And a worldview must be formed from what we're taught in Scripture about mankind, on the basis of the changing of the heart. And so it really comes down to whether you can trust that God will change someone's heart so as to give them that worldview to be able to see the glory that you and I see, or whether He's not going to. And if your faith is dependent upon seeing somebody else seeing that glory, you're going to be a pretty weak Christian that's going to be blown about by every wind of doctrine. But once you get that firm foundation within yourself to where you see how these things are related together, then you're not blown about by every wind of doctrine, and you can have a conversation with people from every type of religious perspective or non-religious perspective and not be blown about and not be damaged in so doing, and be able to do so with joy and happiness. How's that?
That was beautiful. And that's really what I'm trying to do right now, is build that foundation. Cause as I mentioned, I'm newly reformed.
Right.
But as of August last year, when I just had that change of heart, I continuously tried to convince my wife otherwise. And I was a bit overzealous at first. And I was like, you know,
I understand.
What? I need to stop.
I
need to stop. I need to build my foundation. So it's funny that you mentioned that, because I was watching this documentary on Nat Geo, One Strange Rock, and it's about, I don't know if you've seen it, but it's the astronauts giving their perspective on the world and seeing the
beauty of how it's
one big system.
Right.
And all these theories that he throw out there, but, you know, God's never mentioned, and they hit this brick wall, and they're like, well, we can build the building blocks of life, but we can't figure out how the walls of cells were created.
Right.
And they just have theories. They just don't really know.
There is much like that. And, I do know something about how the astronauts have interacted with stuff like that, but you do need that foundation. Do you know who Jason Lyle is?
No.
Okay. Look up Dr. Jason Lyle, LISLE, Biblical Science Institute, BSI. And tell him I sent you his direction. Jason's the smartest man I've ever met. So, and also amazingly, one of the most humble men I've ever met. Those two things are rarely found in the same human being, but they are with Jason Lyle. So, I direct you his direction. PhD in astrophysics from the University of Colorado at Boulder. And
I would say that you're pretty up there as far as having, being very humble. I was watching your debate this morning with Abdullah Hamidimi,
Hamini, yeah.
And yeah.
It's hard to say.
Kind of shake your head sometimes, but you know, that's not a year.
That's good. Thank you, John. I appreciate it. And I hope that's helpful to you.
It was. Thank you.
All right, got to run. Thank you. God bless. Bye bye. Good call. Thank you very much for all your phone calls today. You got to do that a little bit more often, I know, but you all made it work real well for me, so I appreciate that. We will see you, Lord willing, on Tuesday. God bless.